I was driving my mom to the hair.
All right, let's make sure you are in fellowship, and let's continue on here dealing with this matter of the things we are to focus our attention on in terms of the thinking processes, consideration of things in the world that fall under the description of these adjectives. We left off here, we finished with point 19, lies and all that. These are this is the means he employs, of course, to deceive mankind and keep people in darkness. His kingdom is one of darkness, characterized by darkness, deception, lies, and all of that. And the people that fall for that, obviously, become his pawns. They become captive to do his will. And believers can fall into that, as we see back in 2 Timothy there. That believers have been taken captive by Satan, and they're actively doing his will rather than God's. So truth, point 20 here is where we're ready to resume now. Truth is the very basis for belief. If one believes what is not true, it can result in serious and even deadly problems for that person. If one is not careful with regard to the truth, there can be social. People generally do not like liars. And legal ramifications for lying in certain settings. For example, of course, perjury. And if one believes things that are false, it can certainly have an adverse impact in one's life. Calories don't affect my weight. Sunscreen is a sham. And the virus came from a lab. The virus came from a raccoon dog. The virus came... It doesn't matter what you believe about some of this stuff. But some of the stuff, we will never know the truth. But the things that we can know the truth of... they're shooting you up vaccines because they're planting chips in you. No, they're not. They don't have to plant a chip in you, you moron. You got a cell phone. They know where you are all the time. If they want you, they can get you. This is what, and people, it astonishes me that people will commit these crimes using their cell phones. Or calling in a false, you know, there's a new deal now out there of swatting people. You call in a SWAT attack to some innocent person. But I hope they find these people and do some real damage to them. That'd be nice. But they won't, unfortunately, sadly. Well, and in the worst case scenario, may lead to death. I can beat that train. There's lots of ways to get to heaven. So obviously, your belief system is quite important. It determines who you are, because as a man thinks, so he is. And so we have to watch our thinking. Of course, this is where it all starts. Since God is true, point 21, and deals only in the realm of truth, the early church has made the assertion that all truth is God's truth. No matter where it is found. And that's true. 2 and 2 always equals 4. It never equals 5. That's always true. There are certain things mathematically, in the world of physics, in the world of chemistry, they are true and you can't change them. That's just the way they are. And you have to just accept it and deal with it. So, again, the world doesn't have any corner on the truth. And they really don't have truth that believers need in that regard. The believer has to find the truth in a better source than the cosmos. Not that there isn't some truth out there. We acknowledge that there is. But the truth out there is so skewed very often, and so many times it's compromised with so much other junk that it's just not good. So as a corollary here, point 22, if one is going to pursue and embrace whatever is true, there must be a corresponding exposure and rejection of those things that are false. And so being a part of the truth isn't just, okay, I've got the truth. It's that I reject what's false. That was one of the interesting things there in Romans chapter 12 when you're dealing with that rather extended definition of love. Love is not hypocritical. Love is this, love is that. Love is to hate evil is one of the first things right out of the chute. That love is to hate evil. And so you can't effectively love if you're out there involved with the evil in the world. That's not a part of that. So the second adjective here now Paul uses, the second quality he's going to deal with in our verse is semnos. Honorable is the way it's translated. Usually I'll put at least the New American in there, unless there's a more literal one, but which is otherwise only found in the pastoral epistles. It's found in the pastorals and 1 Timothy 3 there. And 3:8, And when it says deacons likewise, although this quality was not mentioned, I don't believe in the first part of this, in the pastorals, or the things aimed at the pastor. No, it wasn't. But when it says deacons likewise, this means that this quality is also incumbent on the pastor too. When he says likewise, he's saying essentially whatever I want out of the pastors, I want the same thing out of the deacons in terms of these moral qualities. And that one, dignified, I think, was the way it's translated there. 1 Timothy 3:8. Deacons must likewise be men of dignity, not double-tongued. Part of being dignified is you don't talk out of both sides of your mouth. There can be, that can get into lying. It can also get into deception. It can get into the kind of behavior where you tell one person one story, then you tell another person another story. That would be double-tongued. And so dignity here, not addicted to much wine or fond of sordid gain. These are two things that affect the sort of dignified demeanor you want to present. 1 Timothy also, their wives must be dignified. Or it's translated as women, I understand that, but in particular to context, when you're dealing with this word can easily be translated as wives in certain contexts. So women be dignified, it's the deacons' wives that are in view here. Dignified, not malicious gossips. So he uses the same sort of dignity, the term for dignity, that he uses of the men, of the women as well. And then he kind of goes into the negative aspects of what doesn't define dignity. Malicious gossips, temperate, being faithful in all things. And then Titus 2:2, I believe that's once again, that's actually, I believe, directed to not the pastors, but Titus 2:2, older men are to be temperate. That means they're to be more mild, dignified, sensible, sound in love, sound in faith rather, sound in love and sound in perseverance, that they're known for hanging in there. And we all get tired of the fight. We all get tired of running the race. If anybody here wants to tell me you've never thought about quitting even once, try me. I'm a gullible. I'll believe it. You probably got some land here in Florida I can buy too, out in the swamp, you know. No, we've all had that. But the fact that we hang in there speaks to a certain degree to your dignity, that you persevere in these things. So they are to set examples for young guys. If an old guy throws up his hand, just says, look, this can't be done, and blah, blah, blah. Well, the young people that want to emulate that will not have a good example to follow. That we continue to, even when we don't know, Paul says we're perplexed. We don't always have all the answers. I wish we did. That'd be nice if I was perfect. I would like to be perfect. Mm-hmm. But you wouldn't like me anymore if I was perfect. It wouldn't make any difference at a certain level. But none of us are ever going to attain to that in this life. We know that. But to set the right example all the time, that'd be great. To always make the right decisions. And we can do it a lot, and hopefully we do. But ideally, you'd like to do it all the time. Well, in Greek literature, this adjective was used of divine beings with the idea that they were worthy of reverence because of their exalted nature. And when it's used of men, it has the idea of one who is worthy of respect, a one who conducts himself in a manner that is honorable and dignified. And here it denotes anything or anyone that rises to the level of the majestic, things that elevate the mind from the crass, the vulgar, or the demeaning. And I go back sometimes and I look at certain things that I used to think were really funny. And I realize now, maybe they're not as funny as I thought. Maybe they're crass. Maybe they're vulgar. Blazing Saddles I thought was a funny movie. But probably not everybody's cup of tea. There's a lot of crass vulgarity in it. And Mel Brooks was famous for this in his movies anyway. Certain people had a tendency to do certain types of things. You know who the Farrelly brothers are, right? The kind of movies they make. But a lot of that stuff's not edifying. Now, this is not a command, don't watch movies. We don't care if you watch movies. You got to figure out what you got to do in your Christian life to some extent on your own. But we can point out that some of this stuff, I don't find myself watching as much TV. Like I said, though, I'm trying to get rid of everything on my box and cut the cable and be done with it. I think I will keep my home phone, not through that company, but I'm going to get another internet phone so I can go ahead and keep that phone number. So that makes things easier for everybody else. So, again, we want to focus on those things that are, maybe instead of listening to Baby Got Back, you listen to Beethoven. Maybe instead of listening to rap music, I use that advisedly because it's not music. But it qualifies under certain definitions of music. But it's crass, it's vulgar, it's coarse. There's really no place for people slapping around the bitches and the hoes, you know. But why do people want to even listen to that? What's that designed to do? That kind of junk doesn't really need to be in our thinking. And what does it do? Of course, it influences people that are easily influenced, like younger people. These become their role models. I want to be like Britney. I want to be like Justin Bieber. Oh, no. No, you don't want to be any of these people. Trust me. Well, as Bruce has observed, F.F. Bruce, the mind that concentrates on ignoble or shameful matters is in danger of becoming ignoble itself. And that's the danger. You become what you think. And so we have to really watch what we think, what we focus on. And again, we don't want to be, on the other hand, I mean, people don't want to look at you and think, oh, that's a believer. He has no fun whatsoever. He's dour all the time. There's no happiness or joy there. And this is the Christian life. That's not the example we want to set forth. But on the other hand, we have to be aware that the cosmos is a filthy cesspool of junk, mostly. That's what it is out there. So 28 here, the third adjective he describes is dikaios here, fair, just, or right, which deals with that which is in accordance with the highest standards of righteousness and justice. In the Greco-Roman world, this type of person, was one who upheld the expected customs and standards of behavior that made for a civilized and ordered society. And this is things like manners. I mean, I never noticed it, but Linda told me she did, and other people may have mentioned it, I don't know, but I know Linda told me about it, and she goes, you know, when you go to some other states, people are more mannered than they are here. People don't have any real sense. I mean, I see a lot of that all the time. Watch somebody walk out of the store looking down at their cell phone, step right into the street. I mean, that's just downright stupid. That's not just a bad sense. That's stupid. You can die from that. But this is the nature of the cosmos. They're just absorbed in their own little worlds. And so to try to be polite and mannered and treat people with respect. And if they make a mistake, be nice about it, if you can. We had a situation. We tried a new restaurant here recently, and we gave it one. The first experience was just god awful horrible. They ended up having to refund all of our money, and we got a horrible meal. So lucky us. Tried him again. Said, okay, well, here, he said, you know, here's the deal. Here's a coupon. You can use this. Try it again. Blah blah blah. Try it again. No better. Same thing. Food order wasn't right. Food wasn't hot. Just, you know, and so when they called back, I said, well, look, I said, I don't want to talk about this right now. I said, I'm a little upset about not having an actual meal here to eat. So, but, you know, call me in a few days and I'll calm down. But I just intend to tell, it's rather than deal with it when I was upset. I just said, look, well, just give me a call in a few days and we'll talk about it. And I intend to tell them I'm sorry, but thanks, but no thanks. I don't want any more free meals or we just don't feel like your place is for us. And so, but at any rate, I try not to deal with things. And that was one of the things, you know, when you're dealing with disciplining kids, you don't discipline them when you're mad. You try to deal with them when you're even-tempered and mild-mannered and all that, and calm. So, again, you want an orderly society, well, we have to be civilized to each other. This means if somebody cuts you off, you don't salute them, even if you want to. And you'll want to, believe me. But if we have to observe these kinds of things and try to set an example. Even though nobody notices, we know God sees it. We know God sees our behavior. So rather than cursing the light, let's just light, or the darkness, let's just light a candle. That makes a little more sense. So the righteous man was a law-abiding citizen, whose duty and responsibility was to conduct himself in ways that were right in the sight of God, as well as conducting himself in ways that were right, fair, and just toward his fellow man. And 31, some interpreters understand right to refer to the natural order of things, since it does not actually depend on divine revelation. For instance, even some unbelievers recognized obedience to parents as a part of natural revelation. Romans chapter 2. And so you don't have to know everything in the Bible to understand what's right, to understand what's just, to understand what's appropriate in society. 2:14 and 15. For when the Gentiles, who do not have the law, see, they had no law saying if your children was disobedient that you should not badmouth your parents. They didn't have any laws about that. Those were part of the Mosaic law, but not a part of general law out there among the Gentiles. But he says they instinctively do the things of the law. They do what's right. These not having the law are a law to themselves. And he's not using this law to themselves as in a bad way here. Normally when we use that phrase, that they're laws to themselves or a law to themselves, that they're arrogant and narcissistic and don't answer to anybody. That's how they view life. That's the way they go through life. But he says that in a good sense, they're a law to themselves, in that they show the work of the law written in their hearts, their conscience bearing witness, and their thoughts alternately accusing or else defending them. And so certain things, you don't have to have a law to know that murder's wrong. You don't have to have a law to know that violence is wrong. You don't have to have a law to know that certain speech is inappropriate. Now, there are laws like that, but you don't need a law necessarily. Certain things are evident. Now, this is one of the problems. Which of these self-evident truths do people get? Well, they get only sometimes the ones they want to, sadly. So again, this doesn't depend necessarily. You can figure out what's right apart from the Bible in some way. Certain things you could figure out that this is right. Of course, my parents made me do it, but they said, you cannot hit your little brothers. And believe me, I wanted to on multiple occasions. But I always knew I was going to get in trouble for it, and so I just didn't. Don't tell me punishment isn't a deterrent. I know for a fact it was and still is, if it's ever used. Well, 32, thus this principle is not confined to just simple biblical revelation. A number of authors recognize that it is indispensable, that it was indispensable for a stable society. A Greek and Roman moralist advocated it, while Stoics taught that it was obvious from nature and was something that was required by reason. But while pagan moralists, point 34 here, and philosophers had their own ideas about what was considered to be right, for Paul, what is right is determined by God and his word. That's the final say for us. It has to be. That this is a higher standard. That God's standards surpass my ways are higher than your ways. My thoughts are higher than your thoughts. And my ways are right. And that's one of the things the Old Testament says. The law of the Lord is right. It's clean, it's pure, it's true. That God doesn't have all these bad qualities, as it were, in his word. So, again, and part of the problem with the pagans and the moralists, too, is they don't always agree which of these self-evident truths are self-evident. See, to me, it's a self-evident truth from nature that homosexuality is an abomination. You didn't have to have the Bible to tell you that. There's something that's just wrong. You can tell there's something wrong. And so the fact is people could figure out some of these things if they chose to. But they want to go along with the cosmos. We have now officially dumbed society down to where it is literally the least common denominator of the scummiest people in the world determine morality. And that's not the way it's supposed to be, unfortunately. Well, the fourth adjective here that he deals with is hagnos. This is the one translated as pure. Whatever is pure. Which is derived from a verb that means to dread. To stand in fear or awe of the gods. And the term referred to things that had some relation to deity. Thus it came to mean holy, or more specifically, pure. The gods were not considered to be impure. They were considered to be holy. They were separate from men. That's what holiness focuses on, the separateness of them apart from the human race and above the human race. Not that we think those gods existed, but obviously the pagans did. So the possibility that sexual activity was thought to make a person ritually unclean led to this term being used in the moral sense of chaste or sexually pure. For instance, you see it that way in 2 Corinthians. Second Corinthians 11:2. He says, "For I am jealous for you with a godly jealousy." This is the appropriate mental attitude of the pastor or of any communicator over those that he teaches. That he wants them to excel, to do well at all of this, to show up at the Bema seat and not hang your head in shame or slink away in shame. "For I betrothed you to one husband, so that to Christ I might present you as a pure virgin." And there in that context, obviously using the term virgin, it has a sexual connotation, sexually pure. And then Titus, also 2:5. I think this is the one to the women. Yeah. This is what they are to teach the older women, or to teach younger women to be sensible, to be pure, to be workers at home, kind, being subject to their own husbands, so that the word of God will not be dishonored. And believe me, I've run across women who are married to men. I'd love to be able to tell them, no, don't listen to him. But you can't. Even if he's wrong, even if the whole situation's wrong, you can't tell them that. They still, as believers, they have obligations to fulfill their requirements in their own marriage to their husband, and fulfilling what they promised in the marriage vow, just as the husband does. Well, 38, while sexual purity is included within the scope of this term, it would also extend to purity in regard to one's motives, one's speech, and one's actions. So people can certainly have impure motives. They can do things because, one, they can make it look like they're doing something out of altruism, when in fact it's something that benefits them. And people are good at this. People are good at trying to manipulate people and to get them to do what they want. So our motives should be pure. They should be above reproach. We're not trying to put something over on anybody. We're not trying to take advantage of anybody. That was one of the things Paul said. "Have I taken advantage of any of you, crafty man that I am?" I'm very crafty. But have I taken advantage of any of you? And the answer was no, he had not. And he very much made this a policy, particularly financially, in these churches. He, first in the initial evangelization and all, he would never accept money. He would never make money an issue. Now, these churches, as we know, did support him. We're dealing with one of those right now in the Philippians. And they supported him on multiple occasions. And that's a whole different deal than going in and taking an offering while you're trying to evangelize people. That suggests to them that somehow this doctrine of the gospel is connected to money. And it's not. And you can't send that message that it is. And so it's best just to avoid all that, and Paul did. And then there were even churches, of course, like the Corinthians, where his motives were pure and he wasn't going to take money from them. Because their motives weren't necessarily pure. So they were trying to say that he was just like some of these other false teachers and fake apostles that were running around. And Paul said, no, I'm not. Number one, I've never taken a penny from any of you there in Corinth. And they have. They've taken a lot of your money. That's one of the deals with these false teachers. They're in it for the money. Why wouldn't they be? And for some people, I'm convinced, I've heard people say it, that, you know, get into the ministry. It was an easy way to make a living. No, it's not. You may think it is. If you're doing it right, it's not. It's difficult if you're doing it right. But so anyway, so our motives have to be pure. Our speech should be pure. Obviously, we have to watch how we talk. Again, crass speech, vulgar speech, coarse speech. We don't want to offend people. And some words just are offensive to people. So we try not to use those words. And of course, in our cancel culture, you inadvertently use one of those words, well, you'll be gone. They're going to get rid of you. But that's as ridiculous as anything as well, too, that culture now is determined by the culture itself, not what it is. So the fifth quality Paul addresses is seen in the adjective prosphiles, to have affection toward, literally. It's translated as lovely in the New American Standard, which is used only here and not found in any of the virtue lists of Paul's day, which tells you he wasn't simply borrowing from them, that this quality wasn't even in their list. The term is used in a passive sense of that which causes pleasure or delight. It has the idea of those things that are pleasing or agreeable. And of course, this term, as I've mentioned, all of these terms are found in the Septuagint. So this would have been something with which Paul was familiar from his Jewish background, the Greek copy of the scriptures. So it's used in the, it's found in the Septuagint, where it's used of a person who commends himself by his wise speech. It is also used of a person who makes himself attractive to the community at large. A wise man by his words makes himself beloved. The word beloved there is the translation of the word we're looking for here. But the graces of fools shall be poured out. That's in the non-canonical book of Sirach. Both of these are non-canonical. But this was a part of the Hebrew writings. So get yourself the love of the congregation. Make them love you. How do you do this? Well, humility is a big part of it. Bow your head before a great man. This is the way you appeal to people, is humble as opposed to arrogant, as a giving as opposed to taking. There's two kinds of people in this world, as we know, the givers and the takers. And we want to be among the givers. And that has pitfalls all on its own. Number one, you're going to get tired of it. You're going to get tired of watching people do the wrong thing while you're expected to do the right thing. And that will wear on you. I want to warn you. But then don't throw in the towel. That's kind of the whole upshot of that. Yes, you may get tired. Do not, Ben Paul addresses this in Galatians. Do not grow weary in doing what's right. And you can. That soul fainting can set in. You think, I've done what's right for years. But this is why we put aside. We don't focus on how well we've done in the past. Those things. And look forward to what lies ahead. How are we going to apply in the future? Going forward. That's what we have to put our focus on. So the sixth adjective here is euphemos. Literally well-sounding. A nice sound. Which pertains, now that's the last one, and it was translated here, of good repute, is the way it was translated. So the sixth adjective is that which pertains to what is said with cautious reserve. One should choose words carefully when dealing with transcendent beings or speaking with one to whom deference is due. Some authority in life. You got to watch the way you talk to God. You got to watch the way you talk to the king. You got to watch the way you talk to any authority, because they have authority and they can use it against you. Not that they will all the time, but again, this is part of us being wise. So although many translate this term passively, i.e. well spoken of or having a good reputation, this word is not used elsewhere with a passive meaning. It is only used in the active sense of speaking well. And so the idea is one who speaks well has winning and attractive ways. It's used of expressing oneself in a way that is kind and likely to win people, while avoiding what is likely to give an offense. And that's one of the dangers, of course. We know that, and Jesus taught this on several occasions, but stumbling blocks are going to come. There are going to be those things that make people stumble. We want to try to not be those things. We want to try to not be engage in behavior that makes people stumble, that makes them think, I don't want to do any of that, anything he's promoting. That's not attractive. He's not attractive. And so we have to recognize, of course, we always, while we're out here and dealing with the world, we always represent the Lord. We're always, only thing they see of Jesus is us. Scary, isn't it? That's all they see of God, is us. We're the visible representative of the invisible God. And so we want to conduct ourselves in ways that are appropriate and all of that. And not try to give offense to people. I know when I was younger, but of course I was taught the doctrine essentially was that if they're not positive, to hell with them. And that's just not the attitude of the scriptures. And it's just not what the Bible teaches. But it was accepted. Because some of this was just reactionary theology. They recognized that the fundamentalists had gone way too far goofy. And so they were going to fix all that by going too far back the other way. Well, this is the theological pendulum that swings throughout history, by the way. It's always going on. Now we tended to be much more towards the cold, the lukewarm, and all of that. But the fact is here, we want to do those things which are appropriate. We don't want to give people excuses. Why? They aren't doing what's right. Well, that believer didn't treat me right. Well, first, that's not an excuse. It's going to fly at the bema seat anyway. People didn't treat me like they should have. Let's see. Could there have been anybody that that might have been true of? Anybody that really faced a lot of undeserved suffering, even dying for sins, let's say. And he wasn't treated well. Well, how do we expect? And we've been warned, and he warned the disciples multiple times. The way the cosmos treats me, if they hated me, they're going to hate you. If they love me, they'll love you. But the problem is their relationship with God, or the lack thereof. So this quality is one that is reflected in the book of Colossians, where Paul instructs those believers with respect to the quality and nature of their speech. Colossians 4:6. Let your speech always be with grace. The as though isn't there. It shouldn't be there. They just supply this. But it's actually another quality of speech, seasoned with salt, so that you will know how you should respond to each person. Three things are evident in that verse. The first is that any speech, it says your speech and it doesn't qualify it. So this isn't just as you discuss things privately with somebody or as you're in a public forum, a public setting. That speech, public or private, is always expected to conform to this standard. I suspect this is an imperative. It's probably here a third person imperative. It gets this helper, let your speech be gracious. I don't even know that we have a verb there here. We actually have the word of you always with grace. There isn't actually a verb there. But again, that has the force when you just read it. A bare statement like that comes across as a command. This is the way it's supposed to be. This is the standard. The second thing is that speech should always reflect the reality of grace. The one speaking should use speech that is kind, courteous, and expresses goodwill. And the sin nature knows nothing of that stuff. The sin nature is not kind, courteous, nor does it express goodwill all the time. The sin nature says, I don't care. Get out of my way. Or if you get in my way, there's going to be hell to pay. And that's not the kind of people, you know, going through house or life like a bull in a china shop. Making a mess as you go. As we saw about the cosmos, misery and destruction are in their paths. We don't want to be like that. The third thing Paul mentions is that a speech of being seasoned with salt, which is a metaphor that has left interpreters divided. There's a number of views on this. Some see it as a continuation of the figure, the grace figure of speech. And that's how the New American Standard did when they said, with grace as though seasoned with salt. The speech has to be gracious and seasoned. To denote the fact that the believer should speak in such a way as to make his words tasty, palatable, and acceptable to his audience. Proverbs 16:21. That's one of the views on this. I'm going to give you several of them, in fact. Proverbs 16:21. The wise in heart will be called understanding, and sweetness of speech increases persuasiveness. If you want to win people, you want to speak in conciliatory fashion. You want to speak in a humble fashion. You don't want to come at them with both barrels blazing and that sort of thing. So this is one of the ways they see this as a continuation, that the gracious nature of your speech makes it seasons it for them, as it were. It makes it palatable, makes it taste good. While this does not suggest that the believer is to compromise the truth in order to be pleasing, it does indicate that he should seek to avoid giving offense when possible. And I think in 1 Corinthians, if I remember, that's just the verse that says we don't want to give offense to anybody. anywhere, anytime. I mean, this is pretty broad command here. Give no offense, either to the Jews, to the Greeks, or to the Church of God. And so he separates, obviously, in terms of the cosmos, Jews and Greeks. That would be everybody out there that isn't Jewish and Jews. And then the church is separated from that as a separate entity because it's not a part of the world and all that. So F, there is also a line of thought found in rabbinic literature that associates salt with wisdom, which is also found in the immediate context of Colossians there. Back in Colossians 4, the previous verse, conduct yourself with wisdom toward outsiders. Making most of the opportunity, let your speech be with grace, seasoned as it were with wisdom, would be how they would see this. That you want to have wise speech. Now, I think both of these things are true enough. I think that you want to use speech that is winsome, that's winning, that wants to win the person. I think also speech should be wise. It shouldn't be characterized by folly and stupidity and all of that. So other interpreters cite some parallels in Greek and Roman literature, which suggests that speech should be appealing and witty as opposed to dry and dull. And, the Bueller, you know, you see people talk in a monotone and it's boring to even listen to them. Sometimes boring to look at them. So I don't think this is what's in view here, just to point out that this was one of the thinking out there, that speech should be sparkling, as it were, that you should be not talk in ways that are just boring and all that. Well, since salt was regularly used as a preservative in the ancient world, point H, some take this as a way of saying that speech should be reflect purity and not be crass or vulgar. Well, other than the last one before this, all of these things are true. I mean, so you can make that point with all of these. But is that which one of them is the verse actually wanting? What's Paul wanting here? However, still others see a reference to salt as a reference to the manner of righteousness that should characterize speech. A Christian should always speak in ways that reflect righteous judgment. And this one's probably the closest to the truth. Not that the other things aren't true in there, but that when he talks about, because he talks about this in another place, Jesus does, and he says, if the salt has become not salty, and that would mean that if your righteousness has decreased or declined, then you're of no value any longer in the plan of God. It's only fit to be thrown outside and cast underfoot and trampled by men, it says. And so it's lost its ability. So speech that isn't characterized by both grace and righteousness would be what's in view here, I believe. That you want your speech to be righteous, but it has to be gracious too, because as we know. However, this must be coupled with the grace factor, point J. Since too much salt not only makes food unpleasant, it can kill you. If you get out of whack in your body between salt and potassium, your heart can go just like that. And so you have to watch that thing. But Proverbs 12:18, generally salt is not going to be deadly. You'd have to eat a lot of salt to be killed, but it can make you sick. I remember one morning this is back when I was first saved. I was going out to help on this crew. I was being a plumber's helper, and I went out with them. And it was going to be real hot that day. And they said, "Well, make sure you take a salt tablet." Well, I took one on an empty stomach. You don't want to make you sick. And so too much salt's not good for you, or salt in the wrong time, wrong proportions, and all that. Proverbs 12:18. There is one who speaks rashly, like the thrusts of a sword. He may be righteous, he may be correct, but he may shred you while he's doing it. But the tongue of the wise brings healing. And that's why this factor, this wisdom, has to be coupled with righteousness, and righteousness has to be coupled with grace. That we want all these things. So I think everything is true here, but I think the real emphasis is on this last one, the matter of righteousness in your speech. So in short, it appears that the ideas of wisdom and righteous standards are necessary to balance the grace factor. And the grace factor, of course, is to characterize the speech, along with those other things. All right, we're going to stop there today. We need to have a brief congregational meeting here. And so We will stop there today and pick up here on Tuesday. Thank you, Heavenly Father, for the opportunity to fellowship in the things of your word. We pray that you would sanctify this information to our spiritual growth and future glory, for we ask it in Christ's name. Amen.